Welcome to Baderson. We make up stories, improvised and recorded live. We start each story by choosing a random phrase from a source of text. My name is Mike, and my source is the instruction manual to the Handy Recorder H4N Zoom.
My name is Casey, and my source is the summer 2025 edition of Centrum Magazine, Creativity and Community, Port Townsend, Washington.
My name is Ben, and my source is The Feynman Lectures on Physics by Richard Feynman.
My name is Drew, and my source is The Gulag Archipelago 3 by Alexander Solzhenitsyn.
We will now choose a performer at random to find out which source we're going to use. That performer is...
Casey.
All right. Flipping to a random page. And here we go. The kitchen dance sound created through a crossroads of European and African influences.
Can you read that again?
The kitchen dance sound created through a crossroads of European and African influences.
Merlin loved to spin the egg beater as fast as he could. He really loved the noise it made, the whirring through the air and the shick of the metal on metal.
He was really good at it, but his mom was constantly telling him to stop. She would be busy at work, she'd be on her computer, she'd be walking, she'd be making food, and she would just constantly be riding him about the egg beater practice he was doing.
They were immigrants from Kenya living in France, and it was important to learn to cook in France. So
Merlin's mom taught him all the traditional Kenyan types of cooking and ways to cook, and he loved that food, but he really felt like as a part of his journey to settling in France, he really needed to learn French cuisine.
So he read from this book by a Kenyan chef who studied in France. The Kenyan chef's name was Pascal, and he lived today in Paris, although he's very, very old now. But this book was well-worn. Merlin went through it every day. It was the perfect tutorship, he felt, mentorship. He wanted to follow in Pascal's footsteps and be a chef as accomplished as him, and one who stayed true to the past and present home as well as Pascal did.
And Merlin was just about to finish high school, and he didn't really want to go to college. He wanted to be a chef. And he didn't
His mom was not cool with that, though. I mean, she loved that he was into this as a hobby, and he was very skilled, and she loved that. But like a lot of immigrant families, she was mostly concerned about how much he would earn. It's such a competitive field. As a chef, you can grind your life away in some nowhere restaurant. One in a million, one in a trillion, she would say, is a Pascal. To me, you are a Pascal, she would say. But Merlin, what if the world doesn't see you that way? What will you live on? What will you live on, she says.
And Merlin would say, Mom, everyone needs to eat. Everyone always needs to eat. So I can go get a fancy degree. I can go get some job that might not exist 5 years from now. Or I can do the one thing that has been the most necessary job for the entirety of human existence. I can make food.
And she
it
would
was
ask
the same
him,
argument they'd have day after day, and it would always end with her saying, well, if you do it, can you do it quietly? And then she would leave the kitchen, and he would beat his eggs more quietly instead of making that sound he loved so much.
Now, Merlin had kind of a secret plan up his sleeve, which is that he wanted to be a chef, but he wanted to be a performative chef. He wanted to be one of those flashy, crazy chefs, and he figured that that would be his angle. You know, he would be totally true to the various culinary traditions, but he spent gradually more and more time juggling with egg beaters and other kitchen implements and kind of working on an act. And in his head, he would sort of imagine himself performing and everybody laughing and clapping. And it was kind of becoming less and less about the food as time went on.
This all dates back to a trip that when he was a child, he and his mom took to the United States. And they went to a Japanese restaurant where there was all sorts of performative quality, where the chef was chopping stuff up in front of people and flipping it around and flipping the knives around and slinging the food all over the place. And Merlin did not like the food. he didn't care for the food, but he was absolutely blown away by how amazing it was to watch this chef do something that was normally so thought of as so calm and so solo and so behind the scenes be such a performance unto itself.
He loved the controlled chaos of it. He loved the noises it made, the staccato, like the clapping, the shouting, the flames erupting, the chaos all around. And he tried to replicate that in his own kitchen, his mother's kitchen, which is exacerbated her
frustration with him. She
put a ban on it. She said, no more cooking. You're good enough. You can make your own meal now. You don't need to practice. You need to study. And so she banned him from cooking at home. And she made him get a job. He answered the phones at a trash collecting company.
He collected trash at a skateboard building company.
He rode skateboards at a
phone distribution company.
He would make calls to trashy skateboard companies all over France and figure out what they needed in terms of supplies.
The point is, he had a lot of odd jobs.
Yeah, way more than his mom actually asked for, and he was lying to her about going to school because he was working four jobs and leading essentially a full double life. He did this for months, working himself to the bone, making extra money so that he could rent a commercial kitchen in downtown Marseille, where they lived, and keep perfecting his act without her interfering.
And his plan was to rent that commercial kitchen. And he actually was on his way to check out a space that on paper sounded perfect. It was right below a cathedral on a hill in a really hip area of town where there were clubs and motorcycle shops and flower stores and just everything.
It would normally be way too expensive for someone in his position to rent a place like this, but the building had a few issues and the owners kind of liked his chutzpah, you know, his entrepreneurial spirit, and so they offered him a pretty good deal.
And the coolest thing about the space was that it had a kitchen in the back and it had a garage door that opened in the front that had sort of a bar in front of it. And the whole kitchen prep space was just set back from the bar a little bit. So it opened up onto the street and there was a place for people to sit at the bar, but also room for people to kind of stand around on the sidewalk and look into the space.
One of the reasons it was so cheap, but also one of the reasons he was so excited about it is that it had pipes coming through it, the carrying steam, and every now and then they would just erupt, like shooting sprays of steam out, not towards the places where people were sitting, but kind of at odd angles from the kitchen.
It's very cinematic.
And what is his job?
He was charmed by the place when he walked in, and when he told the landlord what his plans were, you know, kind of briefed him on the business plan. The landlord kind of shook his head a little and said, well, you're going to have to be some kind of wizard to pull that off.
You're going to have to be some kind of wizard to pull off that dream of yours.
But as long as the rent comes in, c'est la vie.
He played the accordion and left.
Croissant. One of Merlin's jobs had been apprenticing with a construction company. And he learned a little bit of plumbing, a little bit of electrical, a little bit of carpentry. He had some basic skills. And one of the things he did without Monsieur Gaspard's permission was he started playing around with all the infrastructure that was poking through the space. So he actually cut into the steam pipes and he cut into the gas pipes and he set little things, little different stuff up around his space where he could step on a foot pedal and it would actually shoot a burst of steam out of one area of the steam pipe. And he would twist a knob and some flame would come down from a natural gas pipe. And then he would hit a little button with his elbow and it would electrify this grid of metal that he had above. And so as he was working up his whole act, he had all these little extra things he could do. He could throw a scallop up in the air, hit the bug zapper. Hit the bug zapper and then hit it with a burst of steam on the way down. He just had all these theatrical kinetic things where he could use the whole space to make his meal.
Yeah, and the meal was not just it wasn't just a fancy juggling trick. It was preparing the dish. In fact, preparing a 5-course meal, all courses including dessert, taken from Pascal's book.
Late one night, he was hard at work perfecting one or another maneuver, practicing, you know, flipping a cucumber over the back of his shoulder, and he had the garage door open. It was hot. It was a sultry summer Marseille evening. And had a little music on the stereo and a little accordion music. And he was just working on something, tinkering with something. And he heard a voice say, what in the hell is this? And he looked up and his mom was standing at the garage door.
She said, I'm walking down the street after meeting with Auntie Cindy. I hear this music. I'm on my way to the bus stop. I stop. I find where the music's coming from. It's coming from my son. My son who says he's at school at this time. My son who is instead doing circus food like I told him, like I forbid him from doing.
But even she can't help but be a little bit impressed with the scene in front of her, because it wasn't just a dingy garage. There was some real presentation happening. He was wearing one of the prototypes of his costumes. He needed to get some exercise in that to see how it was going to work with the maneuvers, and it looked good.
But she could not brook this. He lied to her, he betrayed her, and he was sinking his future. So she demanded that he take the costume off, throw it down, come home immediately, shut down the space, and she
he refused to do it. He said, "No, I have enough money to live on my own.
I got four
this
jobs.
Is my dream," and. She said, what job? You for answering phones? And he said, construction. I do the skateboard thing. And he went on a list and she said, I don't need to hear anymore. You think you can live on your own? Then you do it, Merlin. You big man, you do it on your own. And she left and both of them held back tears, were too proud to let him fall. And it was a long silence after his mother left.
He was heartbroken. He felt terrible, but
they'd been through so much together. They had each other. That was what got them through the very hard life of being immigrants in this country. They had community, they had aunties, but there's nothing like, I mean, home was the two of them, and that was gone now.
And yet he felt a certain new energy, a certain hopefulness and excitement, because he was suddenly free from her sort of overbearing and domineering guidelines and rules and regulations.
And he kept working and he thought, okay, maybe he lost focus. He was distracted by this conflict with his mom. And so he closed everything down, put stuff away, closed up the restaurant front, and went to his house to just try to talk to his mom and see if they could work things out. And when he got to their apartment, he found his suitcase sitting outside of the front door with all of his stuff packed in it and a note that said,
"Good luck. I love you."
He banged on the door, but there was no answer. He shouted. He pleaded.
People started peeking out of their windows, opening their doors.
He wept.
Everybody knew on this street what was going on.
And finally, he took his suitcase and went back to his kitchen, which now seemed smaller, a little bit dingy.
A little more childish makeshift. And hopeless than he had sort of built it up to be in his mind.
He didn't
kind of
feel
seen
like
it through
working
his mom's
on,
eyes.
Yeah. He didn't feel like working on his act anymore, but he certainly didn't feel like sitting alone with his thoughts. So he started rehearsing again and changing it on the fly. And the act was turning riskier, angrier. He was like learning to touch the flames a little bit.
He was expressing himself, not just performing some sort of gimmicky act. He was actually
telling
out
his
some
story,
emotions, telling a story.
And he found moments of tenderness there too, like when he finally makes the whipped cream that he puts on the tart at the end, there, he felt so much love for his mom and how hard it must have been to say those words and how hard it was for him to hear them, and but also how grateful he was to have this dream that was coming true in these moments. He laid the whipped cream on top of the tort and just fell down and wept.
And he just collapsed and he wept. He cried himself to sleep, and he woke up the next day, and he realized he looked at his, he checked his bank account.
Gaspard was not merciful with the rent. You know, you had to pay the rent the first of the month. There was no ifs, ands, or buts. And he had been, but it was getting down to the wire.
And he had 1 month's rent left. He had spent a lot of money retrofitting the space and getting his getting the space set up and getting all this food and supplies and getting ready to open. And finally he decided, you know what, I've just got to do it. I've got 1 month to do this, or else I'm going to be out of money and I don't know what I'm going to do after that. And so he opened, and quit all four of his jobs. And
well, he spent one day at the phone one, just telling everyone about, it's giving the address. It's going to be a great show. It's food. It's carnival. Come. You know, he sold the shit out of his show.
And he was so committed when he opened, when he had that big night where he had really connected deeply with the food and the menu and the process and the performance and fully integrated his story into it, it had been, he had brought together all different parts of his life in Kenya, his life in France, and the food that he had learned to cook from his mom and all the things that he'd learned from the book from Pascal. But he thought when he opened, he decided he to prove himself, and because he thought that the market would respond more favorably to it, he was only cooking French food when he opened. That was what he was committed to. And so he opened, and he'd put flyers around, and he'd made all those phone calls, and he opened, and nobody was there for the first couple days. Very, very few people showed up.
And it was so hard. Because it wasn't just cooking, it was also a performance. And a performance for nobody is just a crazy man banging on pipes and whirling an egg beater, burning himself on the flames.
He felt like a fool. He felt like a child. He was imagining the conversation of groveling back to his mom for forgiveness.
He was recalling all the arguments they had, all the things she said about, this is not a future, this is not a career, you need something reliable. It was coming true. All the worst things she said, the things that he refused to believe at the time, it looked like it was becoming true. But he had no choice but to do it again the next night for one person, and the next night for three people, and the next night for five, and the next night for 32. He heard the chatter. He could. The room felt full. He was hiding behind the stove. He thought this was a joke. How could there be 32 people here? It felt like 1,000 to him.
And in the midst of this euphoria, he's performing. He's just finding his pace. You know, he's electrified. He's flipping knives and whipping up crazy French cuisine. A recognizable figure walks into the restaurant, and he looks up and sees his mother, and she is decked out in the finest clothing she has and is wearing jewelry and, you know, dressed up like she's going to a wedding. And she walks in and with tears welling in her eyes, they make eye contact, and he sees her, and without a word, he gestures to an empty stool by the bar, and she, full of pride, sits down on the stool, and he goes into his best act and is throwing out his best moves. And
on the fly, he decides that he's not going to make the French dish that he was going to make. Instead, he's going to make his mother's favorite dish. And he puts everything he has into it. He burns himself on the flames. He throws the flatbread into the steam where it cures just perfectly. He whips it all up and he presents it to his mother and to the audience.
Uproarious applause.
And
people are weeping.
She takes a bite and says no words, just reaches up, puts both hands on his cheeks and pulls him in, kisses his forehead. He can't say any words, so he just waves and walks to his ready room, unseen by everybody. And he's just sort of catching his breath. He's feeling all tingly. And then somebody, he hears a voice say, "That was quite a show." It was a man's voice.
An old man's voice.
And Merlin sees an old version of the face he'd seen on the front of this book that he'd lived with for most of his life. It was Pascal. And he calls him the Kenyan word for chef.
It says, "How did you learn how to do that?" And Merlin looks at him and says, "Mr. Pascal, Monsieur Pascal, I learned from you."
And Pascal says, "No, you did not learn that from me. That was not cooking. That was Cirque de, I don't know,
culinaire."
and it dawned on Merlin, like, and there was a sour look on Pascal's face, a look of hurt. "You use my book. I hear people talking. You cook my dishes. But what do you do with them? That is not me. This is not my legacy." And Pascal's heart just like breaks. He can't find the words. He feels cold. He wants to speak, but no words are coming. Pascal won't stop talking, though. Keeps saying, trying to set him straight, trying to say, no, like, tell him what cooking is, saying all the things that Pascal had said to many students over the years. And here was a new student doing everything wrong.
And he's sort of going on this like diatribe of just tearing down
food
everything.
What food is for.
Yeah.
And what belongs in the kitchen and what doesn't.
And how you need to embrace where you are, and your food traditions have to reflect the world that you're living in. He's just going on and on and on.
Steam is not a toy.
And
a scallop should never be more than an inch away from a plate. Why are you throwing it like this?
And all of a sudden, he hears his mom's voice say, "Stop.
Do not speak to my son like that."
In Kenyan.
In Kenyan. And the way she said it, a way that had frozen Merlin in his tracks so many times over his young life. And she says, "Do not speak to my son that way. He knows exactly what he's doing.
Your jealousy is a dish
best left unserved."
And Pascal felt powerless. He tried to summon some sort of haughty, like, superiority, but all he could do was grumble and leave. And mother and child were left alone in the ready room, feeling closer in Merlin's perception. Not closer, not equals, but there was new, he felt a different status.
There was a new level of respect that he was feeling from his mom.
He wasn't.
And she said, "I'm so proud of you, baby."
And he said, "I love you, Mom. Thank you for coming. I've got another show to do in just a couple minutes. I hope you'll stick around."
And she said, "Oh, I'll stick around. I'll stick around forever."
The end.
The end.
The end.
Baiters and Stories are improvised and recorded live over the internet. We clean up the audio, but we don't edit, rehearse, or redo any content, for better or worse. Subscribe and find other stuff we do at Baiterson.com. And never forget, when you serve a fine story, everyone goes home full.